Hi, good morning. My name's Rob Sherwood. And actually, I'm hoping to even answer that question, that the production network can, in fact, be the testbed. So I'm from Deutsche Telekom, and this is joint work with my colleagues from Stanford University, Big Switch Networks, and Nasira Networks. And so the problem I'd like to talk about today is it's actually really hard to get good quality, realistic evaluations of new network services. And services means a lot of things to a lot of people, so let me be a little specific. I mean, the set of things that require changes to the network infrastructure, that is, you know, changes to real hardware and real routers and switches. And by example, I mean things like routing protocols, things like traffic monitoring services, or even something a little bit funky like IP mobility. And the problem is, because we don't have a good way of evaluating these things, it's actually hard to decide what should be deployed into the network and what shouldn't. In practice, what happens is that there are good services out there that we don't know enough about to have the confidence to deploy them into the network, so they never see the light of day. And we also have the reverse problem. There are things that do get deployed that still have bugs and are maybe a little bit immature. So this is a real problem, and it causes real problems in the network. And so why is this? Why is this inherently hard? And so first we're going to look at what real networks really are. And so real networks are high-performance, dedicated hardware boxes. They're closed commercial systems. They're very fast, they have lots of interfaces, and except for a small level of configuration that's exposed, they're effectively black boxes to us. We really can't change their innards. And there are hundreds of thousands of these things. There are lots and lots of them, and they're connected in a way that we actually don't really understand. Maybe news to this community, but actually the internet's topology, I'm trying to understand what that is itself an open problem. People have worked on it, myself included, for years, trying to figure out what the connectivity of the internet is. And then so connected to these boxes are even more people. And these people have come to rely on the internet as a dependable service. They want performance, they want reliability. You know, there's e-commerce is a huge thing. And these three factors come together and make it hard to deploy onto the real network. And so as a result, people end up deploying, of course, on test beds. And so by comparison, test beds tend to use software routers because we can at least program those. But of course, there's this issue of performance. Software forwarding is, even though there's software, a lot of improvements in software routers, there's still the performance is an order of magnitude slower, at least, than their hardware brothers. And the number of interfaces, that is the fan-outs, much slower. And of course, typical researcher can't afford hundreds of thousands of these things, so they kind of grab as many as they can and connect them in a way that they think reflects the real topology of the network, but we're never really quite sure, because again, that's an open problem. And last, I mean, generally you can't get lots and lots of people to join your network, so we try to fake people. We try to use synthetic data. We try to grab some very carefully picked traces. And in the end, you know, if we step back, you know, these are two very different worlds. And if we have a service that's very successful on a testbed, it really actually doesn't correlate necessarily very well with what's going to happen on a real network. And so, obviously, this is not a new problem. I'm not the first one to point this out. There's kind of a bunch of approaches that you can take to solve this, each having success in their own dimension. So I mentioned the existing hardware is closed and not programmable, so there's this large open programmable networks movement, kind of typified by NetFPGA or network processors. And while each individual box is maybe not that expensive, if you were to try to make a large deployment, the sum actually ends up being quite expensive. And you still have this issue of fan-out, that is that the number of interfaces is much smaller than you'd want it to be. And another approach is for people to take the test beds they do have and make them bigger. There's kind of these large NSF-level initiatives to make bigger test beds, typified by Vinny, Planet Lab, and EmuLab. And there's a lot of really good research that comes out of this, but it's still not quite ideal for network services. You know, again, software routing is a little bit slower than hardware routing, and there's still this issue of realistic topologies. And last, you know, there's a whole lot of efforts trying to convince users to join experimental test beds. There's a lot of tricks in terms of maybe you can get better performance, maybe we'll give you some money or extra credit to students, or there's even work like Satellite Lab where they try to ensure that if you join a test bed, they'll have minimal impact on your actual performance. But the bottom line is still, it's very hard to get a lot of people to try a new service and actually get a real feeling for how it's going to work in the network. So our solution that I'm going to overview here and present through the rest of the talk, I'm going to call network slicing. And so what network slicing is logically taking a production network and taking a production network and making logical copies. And I'm going to call these logical copies slices. And the idea is that each service is going to run in its own isolated slice of the network. And within that slice, it's going to have complete control of packet forwarding. And then we're going to take the existing services of the production network, that is, you know, what your network administrator already runs, so Spanning Tree, OSPF, BGP, I'm going to run that in its own slice, and then we're going to let users pick on a slice-by-slice level which slice they want to use. Maybe some users will stick with the production slice because they know that and it works well, but maybe somebody will try your experimental slice. And so a critical property that we need for the system to work is strong isolation. That is, it needs to be the case that actions in one slice do not affect actions in another slice. And if we can actually achieve this, if we can actually achieve this world, we actually kind of dodge this testbed problem. Testbed has now become this logical entity that kind of naturally grow with the existing production network. That is, you know, by definition, we're running on real hardware, we have real performance, real topologies, and with real users. And so this could be a pretty nice thing. And so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about how slicing works, and I'm going to introduce these concepts of flow space and opt-in. I'm going to talk about our implementation named the Flowvisor. I'm going to show you a little bit of a taste of the isolation and performance results that we've done. And as crazy as it sounds, people are actually using this as part of the NSF Genie initiative, which I'll talk about in a bit. This is actually deployed on 8 different campuses, and in the future it will be in 2 regional ISP networks. And then I'll conclude. So before I can talk to you about what slicing is, let me show you kind of a simplified view of typical network architecture. And so actually, if you're paying attention to the last talk, this is actually very similar to what they were presenting. So generally speaking, inside a switch or a router, you have 2 kind of logical components. One is the control plane and the other is the data plane. And the control plane is typified by, it's a general purpose CPU running something that might look like a modern operating system, where the data plane is a very custom, high performance, very specific piece of hardware, generally a custom ASIC. And generally what happens is the control plane makes some sort of decision on how to forward packets. So it creates rules of the form, if the packet looks like this, then push it out a certain port. And it takes a set of these rules and pushes them down into the control plane. And then the control plane takes these rules and enforces them. Every packet that comes off the wire, it matches against a list of rules and performs the appropriate actions. But then, of course, there's a bunch of things, because this is very dedicated, very fast hardware, that the data plane can't handle. For example, packets that don't match any rules, or maybe variable length packets like IP options, and those get pushed back up to the control plane in the form of an exception. And so the thing I really want you to take away from this slide is there's actually a communications protocol between these 2 layers. And so in that communication protocol, there's this notion of rules coming down and exceptions going up. And so kind of logically, once you look at it this way, what we're actually going to do is stick a slicing layer between this. And so this is a layer of indirection. It's going to speak that same communication protocol down to the data plane and up to the control plane. And what this is going to let us do is allow multiple control planes to control the same data plane. That is, this slicing layer acts like a communication protocol proxy between the control planes and the data planes. And so each control plane believes it has control of its own data plane, and each data plane believes there's exactly 1 control plane in the system. And so and how we actually do the slicing is depending on a bunch of slicing policies, which I'll get to in a minute. But so you can imagine then, if that's a slice switch, a network slice is just a collection of switches and routers that are sliced along this way. So if we can individually slice all the components of the network, we can actually get a logical view of an entire network. And so the critical property about this is that we haven't modified that data plane, that special purpose, hard to modify custom ASIC. And as a result, packet forwarding continues with no performance penalty, which is an important thing. And you know, because we and because of the architecture, this slicing layer is actually transparent, both to the data plane and to the control plane. And each slice in what the slicing layer does is, as messages come by, as rules come down, as exceptions come up, it enforces isolation by rewriting these messages, by dropping these messages, to ensure that things adhere to the slicing policy. And this is where we get our isolation. And so I mentioned the slicing policies a couple times, just so I'm going to talk a little bit more about what they are. It's basically a list of resource limits for the network for each service. And so, of course, it's going to include things like how much bandwidth you can use, the number of forwarding rules you can insert, because these are limited on the devices. But maybe not, obviously, things like topology and fraction of CPU on the router that you can use. And last, it also includes which packets are controlled by this slice. And so the notion of which packets I'm actually going to call flow space. That is, you know, the set of all possible flows of packets. And so maybe easier to visualize it, flow space is with this diagram. So if you imagine a partitioning of all possible packets into slices, this graph shows all the MAC addresses along one dimension, IP addresses along another, and ports, TCP ports along another. And say we give slice 3, the green slice here, control of all traffic that happens to match a certain TCP port, for example, HTTP. And so with this notion, we actually have a very nice way of intuiting and rationalizing about how to divide who controls packets in a network. And once we have this notion of flow space, we can get back to this idea of involving real users. And the idea is to allow users to opt into slices at a flow-by-flow level. So it's possible for a user to actually subdivide who controls their traffic. And so you imagine an example where a user says, I want slice 1 to control all of my web traffic because, you know, I've seen the algorithm that they use, and that's optimized for low latency. And I want slice 2 to control my voice over IP traffic, and I know the algorithm for that because it's optimized for low packet loss. And I want slice number 3, which is the production slice, to handle everything else. And by creating this level of granularity, what we actually have is a nice incentive and low-cost method for users to adopt new services. You can imagine this being done by a web form or by a mail to an admin saying, you opt me into a certain slice. And by reducing the barrier to entry and making it easier to get out if they've made a mistake, it actually creates this incentive for people to create high-quality services. You can imagine, you know, one evaluation technique is, well, how many users continue to use my service? And so that's, at a high level, how slicing works. I point you for the paper for a lot of the architectural details. So moving on to the implementation, is built on top of OpenFlow. And so you heard a little bit about OpenFlow in the last talk, but maybe a little more specifically here. OpenFlow replaces the control path in existing switches with a stub piece of firmware. So you replace the control path with an OpenFlow stub, and then you actually move the control logic off the box over the network to some machine you control, typically a commodity PC. And so this control logic in practice ends up being a user space process that talks over the network to the switch. And that communication protocol is actually the OpenFlow protocol. So what we've done is we've moved the control logic off the box that we don't control. We've put an API on that box, and we've moved it off to some box that we do control. And as long as it speaks the API, we can actually control this switch. And so implicit in this is a nice abstraction of the communication between the control and data planes, this critical property that we need. And something that's important, I mean, I don't want to turn this into an OpenFlow talk, but the important thing to take away from this is that OpenFlow actually works in commodity hardware. There's likely boxes in your network right now that you can get the firmware upgrade for OpenFlow. And so once you have this OpenFlow idea and slicing, it's very clear that you can drop a box between the OpenFlow controllers and the OpenFlow switch that does slicing. And that's exactly what FlowVisor does. So walking you through maybe a day in the life of FlowVisor, you imagine a packet shows up to a switch. The switch maybe just got rebooted and doesn't have any rules in it. And so the switch will generate an exception and say, I don't know how to handle this packet, and we'll send it up to the FlowVisor. And the FlowVisor will do a policy check. It looks at its list of policies and say, which controller controls this packet? After looking through the list, it decides that Kathy controls the packet. It forwards the exception onto Kathy. Kathy comes up with some forwarding rule, so if you see packets of this form, then do this with it, and sends it down to the FlowVisor. And so the FlowVisor then does a second policy check. Is Kathy allowed to control the traffic described by this rule? And so both of these are isolation checks. And so once the FlowVisor decides yes, the rule is pushed down onto the switch, and the packet's forwarded at line rate. And so the critical thing is there's caching. So that when the second packet shows up, this rule is already there. You don't have to go through this process again. And the packets just continue at full line rate. And so in implementation, what Flowvisor has is custom handlers for each of OpenFlow's 20 different 20 message types. And really, if you wanted to call this more of a hack, you know, it's really a transparent OpenFlow proxy. It's roughly 8,000 lines of code. I have a new version for anybody who's actually following this is about to come out with extensions for Genie. And you know, I don't want to dwell too much on this, but so if you looked at the, at an architectural level, there's nothing inherent about OpenFlow for this. And you can imagine implementing Flowvisor on something else, for example, IETF's forces, if you're familiar with that. And of course, the code's available online if anybody wants to look at it. But so moving on to the isolation and performance, we have a lot of isolation performance results and in addition some scaling results. I'm not going to get a chance to talk about all of them here. I'm going to take actually the most interesting and actually the hardest case and talk about that, which is isolating the CPU on the switches themselves. And for the rest, I'll refer you to the paper. And so the goal in device CPU isolation is to ensure that no particular slice can monopolize all the CPU on the device, on the switch. And so if this does happen, you can imagine the rule updates stop processing certain internal processes, such as the link layer messages that are sent out to discover links. Those start getting dropped. And if those start getting dropped, then your network starts having flapping links. And then just everything kind of goes bad. And the techniques we use here are not terribly novel. We rate limit the rate that slices can insert rules. And we try to fake rate limiting for exceptions coming up by inserting rules that drop all exceptions and then removing them periodically. So it's a coarse rate limiter. And you'll see in the results, we have some success with that, but relatively limited. But there's going to be proper rate limiters coming in the next version of OpenFlow. And so looking at some performance results, what we have here is a malicious slice and before and after isolation. So we have a slice that's actually trying to saturate the CPU on the device, you know, trying to mount a denial of service attack. And in the blue case, that is without the isolation, the attack is completely successful. It's able to maintain 100% complete utilization of the CPU on the device. But with the isolation in the with Flowvisor, we're actually able to reduce that substantially, something to about 40% on average. And you'll notice that the big spikes here are actually from removing and adding this drop rule. I'm actually being a little bit too ethical here. This is actually the worst result in the paper. But I wanted to make sure that you know this is not bulletproof. But again, once the hope is with the new feature coming out in OpenFlow 1.1, we'll have proper rate limiters in place, and this will actually be a nice smooth curve. So on to the deployments. As crazy as it sounds, we eat our own dog food, which is to say, this is running on our own production network at Stanford. It's about 15 wired switches, about 35 wireless access points. And at any given time, there's at least 25 users on the network, depending on how many undergrads happen by. And we've actually been running this for over a year. And you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, my personal email and web traffic goes across this system. So if it breaks, if the isolation breaks down, you know, I'm the first to know about it. And it's not that we're running a happy, safe, fun network. And other slices of the network are actually seven different OpenFlow-based demos. So these things are almost the worst-case scenario for what a network operator might want, especially if you know some grad student makes a programming mistake and the network starts going crazy. So you can imagine there's some confidence in the isolation capabilities of the Flowvisor. And so it's not just Stanford that's using this. National Science Foundation has this Genie initiative to create a nationwide large-scale testbed. And so this testbed involves many people, many research groups, and is not just OpenFlow based. But there is a large-scale OpenFlow network, and each of these sites in front of you is now running a copy of the Flowvisor on the bottom of their OpenFlow stack. So at some point soon, hopefully by November 2nd, because we'll have a demo then, you can actually get an end-to-end reservable OpenFlow slice of this entire of all the institutions you see here. So. In terms of future directions, right now, so you've noticed I didn't say virtualization at all during the talk, and probably some of you are thinking virtualization. I very carefully said slicing because right now we're limited to subsets of the actual physical topology, and one of the things that you could do with a box, a slicing layer in the place the Flowvisor is start adding virtual links and virtual nodes. And so that's something that I'm interested in pursuing. And also some of the rate limits could be adapted to working better with the actual load as opposed to currently they're constant in time. So in conclusion, you know, the title of the paper is a question. You know, can the production network be used as a testbed? And I would submit that the answer is at least a tentative yes. I've shown you how network slicing can help you perform more realistic evaluations. And the FlowVisor is actually in practice letting us run experiments on our production network with some safety. And it will even get safer once we can get this new feature. We have more than 1 year of deployment experience, and the hope is that something like this stack will be coming to a campus near you. And thank you very much, and I will take questions.
Hi, good talk. Jeff Mogul from HP Labs. So maybe this isn't the paper and I haven't read it yet, but it would seem to me that one of the resources is actually very limited on these switches is the slow setup rate. And I'm wondering how you create isolation between slices so that they don't one slice doesn't dominate the control path by just doing hundreds of flow setups per second.
So the limiting resource in flow setup rate is the device CPU, and that's actually exactly what this graph is.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Abdullah Gharaib, UBC. I was wondering about latency. How does this... you introduce a new layer, right? So to do the... switching between different slices.
I love questions that I have slides for. So a result from the paper that I didn't get a chance to show is this is a message that is sent from the controller down through the flow visor to the switch and then comes back up, so it kind of hits the penalty on both sides.
Right.
And so the result is, on average, we're about half millisecond of latency. It depends on the operation,
yeah.
But in general, it's in the order of milliseconds.
Thanks.
So looking at this from the ISP perspective, in general, the thing that you want to be testing is you want to say, I want to look what happens when I deploy something over in the entire ISP space. Except that doesn't that mean you have to have twice as much forwarding memory now, or n times, depending on how many slices you have, because you want to have each slice have the entire IP space? Otherwise, you're only testing some subset, which goes back to all your problems about not being realistic.
Definitely. There are works in dealing. If you don't have a complete set of forwarding memory available, there are tricks that you can play in terms of caching the best prefixes or things like that. But it is definitely true that the number of rules available to you ends up being a scarce commodity. In fact, I would say that's the second one after the device CPU that I first talked about. That said, hardware manufacturers are now very aware of this. They weren't typically at the... enterprise level, it wasn't so much an issue, but they're aware of it now, and of course ISPs have been aware of this for a long time. And so while there probably won't be a lot of spare capacity, you can imagine having double, so you could run a second service.
Okay, thanks.
So kind of a meta problem here is, in order to run these individual experimental or non-experimental services that are controlling the routing rules, you need some way for the services to communicate with the router. And are you doing that over the network itself by way of some other slice? So, for instance, the control system for this slice may run over the production IP slice or your experimental routing slice.
So the way we've solved this in practice, and so you're exactly right. So effectively, you end up having a in-network control plane. And so what we've done in practice is that the experimental slices use the production slice for the control plane. And if the control plane goes bad, you can imagine other problems. Folks at Nasira Networks, who are co-authors here and actually co-authors on the previous paper, have actually worked out a in-network control protocol so that you can dodge that problem.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.